This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss the legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, Paul Sarker, former Marvel lawyer and current Big Law Media attorney.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani. Paul, how's it going this week?
Going pretty well. All things considered, really good. Got a vacation coming up. It's good. It's a good time in the sports world, good time in the entertainment world. We're just seeing what the economy holds, whether we're hitting stagflation or things are going to keep chugging, or maybe the Fed will lower interest rates. I mean, anything could happen right now. So times of transition are good.
No, for sure. I mean, and in positive New York news, I guess, although I haven't really been watching the games, I've just been watching the results. The Knicks are doing decent in the playoffs.
I know, I'm a Sixers fan, but yeah, it's...
That's right. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
That's a bummer.
I don't think... I wasn't expecting too much this year. I mean, I was a little disappointed that they lost in the first round, but I think their window closed. It is what it is. It's just good for the Knicks. Not going to be easy to beat the Pacers, but the NBA playoffs, I mean, it's the best time. The second round, like, nothing but great teams left.
Yeah, I'm going to tune in. I don't watch basketball during the season. I'm watching soccer. I'm watching Premier League, but you know, now that's, you know, Knicks, it's New York, it's round two. Like, I'm going to start watching. I don't really start watching the playoffs when things are like really on the line and it feels like there's a lot of competition. That's when I usually tune into the NBA.
I mean, at this point, there's no bad games. Second round of the playoffs, I guess technically the first round, there's a game seven as we record this between the Magic and the Cavs in round one. But Western Conference is already into round two. Eastern Conference will soon be into round two. I mean, it's just like amazing the level of talent, because, you know, when players like LeBron and Embiid and Durant are getting ousted in the first round, you know that it's just super competitive.
It's a new time now. Yeah. A new era of players.
The new era, yeah. Speaking of new eras,
exactly.
It's the era of streaming, as we've talked about like a million times on this show. And one of the things we talked about last season, at the end of the season, I think it was episode 241 or so, we talked about how, as part of the SAG and WGA strikes ending, they agreed to have a success bonus in their show structures. So the streamers said, hey, if you're in, a writer in the writer's room, or if you're an actor on a show that's watched by more than 20% of our audience, not necessarily in total audience, but basically like in terms of minutes viewed, then you can get a bonus on your residuals equal to like 100% or something like that. So there's a formula. It's not a huge life-changing amount of money, but it is a sign. It's the first time any of the streamers have been willing to provide any sort of success fee on hit shows. And so the devil's in the details, and one of the things that has made more important and like more prevalent is like viewership on streaming. So in the past, all the streamers would like voluntarily release their top 10 shows for marketing purposes. But now, if you're talent, you have a vested interest in knowing how your shows are performing, because if you're even close to that hit threshold, you want to know whether you're going to get this bonus or be eligible for the bonus. And so what this does is it brings the old technology, Nielsen, back into the new technology. Nielsen used to measure broadcasts for like 60, 70 years. And now it's going to start measuring streaming. And they've been building the technology for a while. But there's a lot of other companies that could measure streaming, because when you're going from broadcast watching in your home, it's harder to track what people are watching. You have to install a device or have them fill out surveys. But when people are watching via broadband or on a device where your IP address can be tracked, all that data is already there. So it's just a matter of, like, Nielsen doesn't necessarily have any proprietary advantage over someone like a Comscore or Adobe, but they do have established relationships.
But it's also like a brand, right? Like, Nielsen has historically been, hey, we trust Nielsen for the data that they put out on broadcast, and that makes sense for something like TV or film, and in this case, streaming, that I would assume, you know, the whether it's the writers, the actors, the studios, all seem to have a level of trust. I don't know. Maybe that's like a really minor part of it.
No, I think it is. I think it's not minor. I think it's two things. It's like, if you've been doing something for 70 years, then you have a lot of built-in expertise and industry knowledge and, like you said, relationships and trust. Now, there are some that have criticized Nielsen as underrepresenting minority viewership and being geographically limited, because their methodology was to just look at, previously, just to look at a sample of homes and have some people fill out diaries,
right,
and have some trackers in some people's homes. But it wasn't 100% coverage. And it was a very challenging thing to cover every household. So they did a sample, which I get. But now in the digital world, you can get, literally, unless someone's using a VPN, you can get data on like what they watch in real time.
But also, it's like, I remember when the Nielsen data would come out about TV, whatever was on cable, and I'm like, how the heck are they actually like this cable box? It just never felt like they really, like, it's almost like a guesstimate and they don't know the exact data, versus if you look at a Netflix, you know when we log in, you know when we press play, we know when you stop, you know when we exit. I mean, there's so many data points at a technology company that's, you have metrics, you have analytics. It seems like it could be a lot more fine-tuned. It could be super detailed. And to your point, you're not like doing it on a subset of people.
This is all, at least initially, driven by advertising. So we needed a way, when I say we, I mean like the industry at large, needed a way to determine what shows had the broadest reach to the broadest demographics or specific demographics, because companies wanted to market their products in the ad breaks. So, you know, if you want to sell a pickup truck or you want to sell a vacation or insurance or whatever it is, right? You want to be able to target your ad spend as much as possible to people that are likely to buy your product or service. So that's why the Nielsen ratings started, you know, 70 years ago, because there was this demand for tracking. And in this case, in the digital world, where like everyone's device, you could have a one-to-one relationship with, as an advertiser to a customer, because you can say, I want to target someone that's a Knicks fan that lives in this zip code because I'm going to promote playoff season tickets. I mean, they're probably sold out, so maybe it doesn't matter, but maybe there's something else you want to do.
Right.
I mean, you can target things digitally in a much more specific fashion, and then you can also gauge the effectiveness of those ads. So it's just the next step in the evolution as technology has gotten better. You know, tracking things and being able to sell to people is much more precise than it was back then. So now, instead of it, you know, random sampling of people doing surveys and writing little diaries for what they watched all week, like, you can get that data precisely from their devices. And yes, since to some degree everybody's tracked, which, you know, has privacy concerns and whatever, but it also allows for a lot greater detail when you are actually looking at something. So like, if you're watching something on a device that's connected to the internet, then the viewership data is like already there.
Yeah. And they're being brought in to essentially make sure that there's a trust in what the streaming platforms are telling them, right? It's like, it's essentially enforcing the data that they're providing them to be like, okay, we're just going to double check your work and make sure that this is right.
You're right, because they're an independent third party.
It's like an audit. It's like having someone come in and do an audit.
Or a double check, right? Because they're not actually going into the books and records of the streamers and actually verifying that what the streamer said is accurate. What they're doing is they're providing a double check saying, does Netflix's data jive with our data? Does Peacock's data jive with our data?
I see.
So they're not really auditing, but they're providing verification. And the thing is, they're independent. So whereas that these numbers released by the streamers of their proprietary information, there's really no way to double check it. So what you do is you, I mean, short of audit, which they're not going to probably, they're going to be reluctant to give those rights. So what you do is you have an independent third-party service that goes across all the streamers. And obviously they're going with one that's been established for 50, 60 years. So basically the new news is that SAG has said, hey, we signed a contract with Nielsen to be our official third-party streaming data aggregator provider. And this is great because it allows standardization across what Netflix's data is, what Peacock, what Prime Video, what Apple's reporting. And so that's, you know, a step forward. It's good for Nielsen. And SAG is saying, hey, we're just holding true to the agreement that we negotiated last fall. You know, we're going to need this data to be a double check on the streamers. And I think it's a win for Nielsen because, like I said, in the digital space, they have more competitors than they did in the broadcast space because that infrastructure is there. Comscore, Adobe, iSpot, Edo, VideoAmp. So Nielsen's maybe the most trusted name in the space, but it wasn't, to me, a definite that they would get this deal.
Right.
So like ratings initially started, I think, as a way for advertisers to gauge, you know, how they're going to spend their money. It really became an important tool in TV networks, so how they would market themselves and how they would make decisions about what shows to cancel. Let's take a quick break and come back in with the traditional broadcast Nielsen ratings.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, speaking of tracking viewership, CBS has come out and announced for the 16th consecutive season, they are the most watched broadcast network. Just to give everyone like a sense of like what that means, they're averaging around 5.59 million viewers per night during their prime time. And so the last time they had a streak like this was between 1955 and 1970, where they had 15 seasons in a row. Now they broke it with 16. And so just to compare that, Paul, NBC had around 5 million viewers. They measured this on the stretch of like per night over 7 days. ABC had 4.39 and then Fox had 3.35. That's when you think about like nightly viewership. When you look on the average of 35 days, so like over the course of a little over a month, you're looking at the average of 10.1 million viewers over the course of that 35-day viewing window.
Yeah, what that means is, right, like if you 35 days from the initial airing of a show, so yes. It's not like, let's say like your favorite show is NCIS and you can't watch it when it comes out because you're busy, you have an event, whatever. You can't watch it on the linear broadcast, but you watch it over the weekend on your computer, or on your TV,
or
on demand or whatever. If you watch it within that 35-day window, that's the how you get to the 10 million number. And that's something that's like, you know, technology is allowing us to track that, which is still valuable to the advertisers because, you know, the ad probably isn't swapped out in the first 7 days or maybe in the first 35 days. So as you said, NBC was at 5 million, ABC is at 4.3 and Fox was at 3.3 million. So, I mean, Mesh, do you have a sense of where that ranks historically? I know the numbers are a lot lower than they used to be 50 years ago.
I was trying to look up this data. I mean, if you think about it, like it's, I mean, you're talking about at a, during a time in the 50s when there were only network channels, and that's what essentially millions
of households when there were three networks and you had like 40 million people watching MASH or whatever it was.
Exactly. Yeah. Or like Elvis is on TV and the entire country is watching at like 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. Eastern time because there's no other way to watch it. So I think it's a bit different, but we're talking more like that's like you're talking like 50, 60, 70 million people watching versus like now where it's like so different. There's so much more choice. And choice is not just like streaming. Choice is you're playing video
YouTube,
games, you're on
Roblox,
your phone, you're on TikTok.
Video, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or you're reading
there's
a book
because
you don't want to be anywhere near. Exactly. And so
books were always there. Books were always there as competition.
Books were always there, but I think I'm saying more in the sense of I need less screen time. I'm getting away from TV. Let me go back to a book. But it is interesting because I think of CBS as it's the type of show. They've got a certain style of show that's NCIS. Like catered to a certain. Yeah, it's your. I'm just going to go through some of the
like,
list.
What? They had like almost more than half of the top 20, I think. 13 of the top 20.
Yeah, so there's trackers. First of all, I don't know what the hell's going on network TV because I haven't heard of any of these shows. So I don't know what FBI is. I don't know what Ghosts is. I don't know what Trackers is.
You don't know what Ghosts is?
When I was reading this and I saw Tracker, I thought, now I feel like an idiot. I thought Tracker was like the essentially
the
some data
system?
Provider that was the rating system. So I skipped over that and I was like, oh, it's NCIS, Young Sheldon, FBI, Ghosts, The Neighborhood. I know Young Sheldon because I see the ads everywhere, but Ghosts or FBI, I haven't heard of. On the buses. And so just to give people...
So Ghosts has like a South Asian lead. So, and I see their ads on when I'm watching football all the time. I haven't seen the show.
It's a spy show.
I haven't seen the show. I've just seen the ads.
Of some sort.
No, it's like a comedy. Like these people live in a house that's inhabited by ghosts, but I think they can only see them.
Totally got that one wrong. Okay, it's literally ghosts. Okay. Just to give people a sense of viewership, like I was like, Young Sheldon, who watches that show? Okay, well,
13 million
apparently
people.
Yeah, 13 million people watch the show average. Yeah. And so I was like, oh, wow. So like some episodes get 20.4 million.
Well, that's Trackers, the number one broadcast show.
That was Trackers. Okay, now this all makes sense of how I was reading it. So,
Wow,
like I need to watch Trackers because clearly this is a very popular show. But historically, I was looking at like, what are the shows that CBS makes? Okay, How I Met Your Mother, 2.5 Men, which is a certain style of comedy, Big Bang Theory, Young Sheldon. So that makes sense. It's kind of like cookie cutter comedy, family, you know, a little like adult family, The Good Wife. And then in the 50s, 60s, et cetera, it was like The Twilight Zone, MASH. Before that, you had shows like, you know, recently Blue Bloods, Hawaii Five-0, Mentalist. These are the shows that I guess there's a certain group of Americans who love these shows and they can watch them consistently.
So in the last season, so 456 billion minutes viewed across all CBS properties and platforms. So that includes CBS, Paramount Plus, Pluto TV, the CBS app. And guess how much NCIS is almost like 80 billion minutes.
Billion. But there's a bunch of them.
And there's
right?
There's
seven of them. Yeah.
Something
I remember,
like that.
I mean, I think I remember I was excited for like LL Cool J and, or maybe that's a different show. They have like their own one.
No, I think
LL Cool J was NCIS Hawaii,
which I think got canceled. People, are
I think
pissed.
It got canceled. But then Chris O'Donnell, from people who remember Chris from Robin in the one of the worst Batmans, but at the time as a kid I loved him, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. He was in NCIS the original, NCIS Hawaii, and now he's in NCIS Los Angeles. Which I'm unsure is still on TV or not. But it seems like, hey, this formula works. Let's keep doing it. People love it. We'll just try different cities or states. People clearly watch the show.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, a lot of people love NCIS. No question about it. It's been in and out of the number one show. Didn't catch Tracker this year, but it's also have so many spinoffs. Maybe you'd have to add them all up. But as we said, I mean, the numbers... 5.59 million per night is a far cry from what it used to be back when there was only three channels and, you know, you had basically a third of America or 40% of America watching one show. Those days are over. There's just too much proliferation, too many options. But it's still something to be said for being number one 16 years in a row. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But part of the challenge when you think about, so CBS, Viacom, you know, they have Paramount, or Paramount is a part of this conglomerate, and they have really been struggling this year with their stock price, past couple of years with their stock price, trying to find a market. They're the number one broadcast network, and that's great, but what does it mean? And what is the value proposition for shareholders? I think it's still a question.
Yeah. So, for example, I mean, when we were talking about competing with things like YouTube, Dude Perfect, for those who know, Dude Perfect is a group of friends from Texas A&M. They went to college together. They're good guys, like good family guys, don't talk about drugs or swear or alcohol or anything like that. And they do trick shots. And now they're pretty big. I mean, these guys on average for every video they release, it's around like 7 to 8 million people tune in to their YouTube video. And that's like, if you compare that to like a Mr. Beast gets like 50 to 70 million people tuning into his videos. And it is really interesting to then look at the numbers of a NCIS, but just know that like those people make good money. The salaries are good. People tune into it. Advertisers still really care about network TV. They understand that subset of America. And I think it is pretty impressive it's either impressive or it's like, has NBC, Fox, et cetera, just kind of fallen along the wayside because there's so much competition in content creation right now?
Well, there's a lot of competition. And it's also a lot of it is sports, right? So CBS, big chunk of their viewership is the NFL postseason. They had the Super Bowl last year. That kind of rotates among the major networks. But yeah, I mean, I remember when I was at Marvel Disney, Disney tried to emphasize getting ABC into number one. I don't think it ever happened while I was there. Because it is a big bragging thing among the network executives to say you're the number one broadcast network. And you know, congrats to CBS for getting that title 16 years in a row. Let's take a quick break and come back with an interesting new Airbnb business. So, Mesha, I bet you think it's really cool.
I love this stuff.
Yeah. When I was reading about this, I was like, this is right up Mesh's alley. So Airbnb, the company that is, you know, it's a noun, it's a verb, game changer, changing the hotel industry, short-term rentals. I mean, what a crazy and innovative idea. Everyone knows what Airbnb is now. And so they are launching this new business or promotional thing, whatever it is. I'm not exactly sure if it's a business because a lot of these stays are free. But it's called Airbnb Icons, and these are one-of-a-kind experiences that you can get through Airbnb. Right now, I think they have like 13 that they're teasing.
Yep.
Staying at the Charles Xavier School in Westchester, New York, which is like a mansion in Westchester that's been skinned and painted and remade into a version of Charles Xavier School. So there's like a danger room, beast's lab. There's a huge head of a sentinel in the front.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And all the bedrooms are themed after various X-Men, which is cool. They also have the house from Up, a Purple Rain house, experiences with like Kevin Hart. He's going to do a private show with 30 people. They have Doja Cat. I think she's doing like a makeup session. Jhanvi Kapoor is a Bollywood actress. You can go stay at one of her cribs. You can stay at a Ferrari museum or actually drive some Ferraris.
Here's what's interesting about this. So like Brian Chesky, who's, you know, one of the founders of Airbnb. I mean, one like founder led company started it just to give people context, like whatever it was like 12 years ago, 15 years ago or around that, like over a decade ago. I mean, this guy was basically, like, it was during when Obama and McCain, they were running for president, and they were selling boxes of cereal called Obama O's and whatever McCain cereal was to pay for like them to get this thing off the ground. And now it's a $100 billion company. It has changed the entire world. It has essentially disrupted hospitality. But he knows that he needs to essentially like make it more than just, hey, I'm going to stay at this house, because a lot of people are complaining about the fact that, look, Airbnb now, and Airbnb can cost a lot more money than a hotel. And I've got to like, you know, there's cleaning fees, there's this, there's that. And he's always listened to what the public says. You know, they started creating experiences, and then he was like, I have this idea for Icons. And we were reading the article.
Well, they have competitors too. I mean, they're not the only game in town that's doing what they did, right? So
yes,
they were revolutionary. Yes. Now they have competitors, VRBO and others. And Airbnb, when it first launched, was way cheaper than staying in a hotel. Now, depending on where you are and what features you want, it could be way more than staying in a hotel, plus you have the cleaning fees. So maybe you get a little bit more space, you get some privacy, you get a bedroom, kitchen, whatever. But it's not super cheap the way it was before. And it's a much more mature platform. The hosts do really well. Guests like it. So it's a really compelling business, but they have more competitors. They need to keep growing.
And they need to innovate on like, what is the experience on Airbnb? And the reason why we're bringing it up in this show is that Brian Chesky was basically walking through an IKEA, and you know how like the rooms are set up? You're walking by essentially like rooms that are set up. And he was like, wouldn't it be cool if we did that at our company, where people could like sleep and stay in these, you know, created rooms? And you know, for example, I don't know if you if you've been to one before, like the Rolling Stones had an exhibit where it was in New York, and the exhibit was like the actual like a replica apartment of where they lived in when they were just starting out. And he was like, "Can we actually make this into a business within Airbnb?" And so you think about like X-Men, you think about Up, you think about Prince's Purple Rain House. It's all this like IP that exists that they're making an experience for people that are affordable. The way I looked at it when I read it was like, he's kind of applying what Disney and Universal have done with theme parks and these experiences and like
That's
pushing it
yeah.
like it could be global where anyone, like any house could become like that. I think it's really cool.
Well, not any house, right? Because you're going to need the IP.
Not any house.
And
a planned house, yes.
And I don't really think this is innovative because it's been done for like, this is me counterpointing. I mean, it's not like he's coming up with the first idea for a themed resort or a themed hotel
no.
or a themed cruise, right? Like these are things, Walt Disney built Disneyland like 70 years ago or 69 years ago. So this thing has been around, like using entertainment and IP to
totally.
Make a property more enticing to, you know, to enhance the value proposition so people spend more to stay there than they would a traditional hotel. Like you can go stay at a hotel in Southern California, but you can't hang out with Mickey and the other characters. You can't go on the rides. So like the thrilling experience of it all, that allows Disney to charge a lot more money for their spaces. I think what's interesting about this is it's also starting out very low cost. Like a lot of these are free, but you have to sort
yes,
of be
yes.
like the one person that gets it, like the golden ticket, which is the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory concept. Or I think the X-Men house is priced at $97 because it's inspired by the X-Men 97 series. So it's kind of promotional and not really like a business right now, but it could obviously in a year, maybe these things are going to cost $10,000, right? Who knows?
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me because only a company like Airbnb is going to get the rights from Disney to do something like this,
right,
like
right.
from X-Men or Up. And I think they also have the control room from Inside Out.
Well, because even Purple Rain, right? Because Purple Rain, the house experience is that you're listening to like things that are exclusive, whether it's watching exclusive footage or listening to certain things, you know, from the estate. Or
yeah,
whatever.
I mean, I would recommend that you get a license from whoever owns the IP if you're going to do something like theme out a house. But for like the Kevin Hart thing, which is, you know, you and 29 of your friends can go see a private show with Kevin Hart. Like, that's cool.
Yeah, I gotta imagine that's going to be expensive.
It's going to be expensive. I mean, I think it's interesting. Is it innovative? No, but it's logically like the next step in expanding their portfolio.
Yeah, and I agree. Not innovative in the sense like it's nothing new. I think innovative for a company that needs to make a new offering and do something like different than just rooms. And I think it's also like brand awareness, right? Like Airbnb, like Brian Chesky is like a kind of a beloved founder. People really respect him. You know, he's on stage. He commands a presence. He knows that the brand really matters. He cares about design. In this case, he cares about, you know, the Disneys of the world. And so from that standpoint, I like that he's like front and center about, hey, we're the place you go for hospitality and experiences. We'll see. I mean, I think a lot of people were like, this is dumb. A lot of people are like, this is really cool. We'll find out like how it scales.
Well, I think the experience thing is legit.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the past few vacations that Jessica and I have gone on, we've done Airbnb experiences. So even if we're staying at a hotel or taking a cruise, like you can still book a tour, like a day trip through Airbnb. And that allows a local host who has knowledge of an area to take you around and give you a non-tourist kind of view of their place or their town or show you something cool like a waterfall or whatever. And so I do think Airbnb is much broader than just booking a house for a week or a month or whatever. But they also, you know, they're facing a lot of legal challenges from cities like New York, where the hotel industry and the housing industries are trying to prevent them from encroaching on that.
I mean, look, I'll say this as someone who's been watching X-Men 97, think it's one of the coolest shows in a long time. Nostalgia, obviously. I'm interested in this house. I want to stay in this house.
Yeah, for $97, you should.
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. For $97, I was like, this seems a bit too low.
Yeah, it's got to be promotional. That would have to be the way they
have to be
got the license.
Have to be. But yeah, look, I think it's cool. It'll be interesting to see, like, does this last? But to your point, I think promotional, I mean, Inside Out 2 is coming out and they have the Inside Out control room and they said that's part of promotional. And so, like, we'll see if it turns out to be, like, a real part of the business and it's scalable. I think that's the key. Like, is this scalable?
I mean, yeah, all these things look pretty cool. Driving a Ferrari on like the you know, where they design them and build them. Yeah. That could be really cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But yeah, so in general, I think that was a fun thing to be able to talk about. But that's our show for this week, folks. Make sure you're tuned into the podcast every week, Spotify, Apple, wherever you choose to listen. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, at Better Call Paul, the podcast. Follow me on X, at Mesh Lakhani. Paul, thanks for a great one. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders.